This will be a really interesting tape for you guys to listen to. You know, 20-minute pauses, absolute silence, that's all right. We talked about the place of what we said, holiness, justice and righteousness, truth, integrity. Those are all words that are clustered together. The importance of that in the relationships in our lives. And the fact that we really can't expect to have any kind of a relationship with anybody where there is no trust. And so it's that reliability that you are, you know, I'm getting what I see. And that there's no hidden agenda going on, or there's no dark side that would change this whole thing in our relationship. As long as there is integrity and trust, there is space for relationship. And then we gave some examples. I gave the example of my own kids, where if I would discipline them out of frustration, they registered that. It's incredible how a 10, 11, 12-year-old boy has just an instinct to know when you're being unfair or unjust. And he has an enormous memory for those things. And those are the kinds of things that will sabotage. Or a relationship with a spouse where, a guy is unfaithful. Well, he's got to hide something. And that's going to erode that relationship. And she may not know exactly what it is that has come between, but there's something obscure. There's a shadow. There's a cloud there. So, and then on into the business world, business partnerships, the basic rules of commerce. Where there is no trust, there is not going to be business. And so it's something that plays out from the most intimate relationships on into even where our enemies are. And so integrity is something that runs through all of them. I'd like us to, just stop and process this. And let me give you a couple of questions to discuss at your table. Give examples of injustice or deceit that you have to deal with in your life. What have you come up against that has been a frustration for you? What kind of lapses in integrity bother you the most? What bugs you when it comes to this matter of integrity? Just in relationships in general, in the business world, the social world, in our society, what are the issues of integrity that you that get to you? The next question is, where do you find it difficult to practice justice or integrity? Those two questions. So we'll just take a few minutes on that. I'll kind of watch the discussion, see how it's going. And I'd say, we'll spend maybe 6 or 7 minutes on this and then go on. Okay? So go to it. What did you discover?
Never got the second question.
Yeah, how many groups got the second question? Some of you did. Sort of. Okay. What were the answers to the first question? What did you come up with? What are the things that irk you most when it comes to just absence of integrity?
Betrayal.
Betrayal
by a friend.
Okay.
Lies.
All right.
Huh.
Do you have any specific examples that you gave that? Okay. All right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
We have the shutters put in, They're a month late. They're not wood. They're pressed something. And 2 months later, they break, and then they don't come and service them. The whole thing's a lie. They just defrauded you right from the beginning. It wasn't what they said it was. They didn't come on time. They don't do the service. And we find that all the time.
Shoddy service.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have an example of a Christmas gift that when we got the gift, it was not according to the advertisement. And my wife called the company back and said, this is false advertisement. And they said, oh, no, it's not. because it says this, this, and this. And my wife said, no, it doesn't say, you know, that there was an issue with the gift, and it was just not what it said in the advertising.
Huh.
And they just, they weren't getting it.
Huh.
She talked to them over and over again, and they weren't getting the message.
Jim, I got a tip. I'm watching Burger King ad, you know, where the guy, the stuff's dripping on his pants. And chili burger. Yeah, the stuff's dripping over the side. Over. So I'm watching that. And I think I gotta have one. I went into Burger King and bought one, and I looked in there, and there's no chili. I mean, you can see that. I said, I think you made a mistake. I took it back, and I said, oh yeah, there's chili. And they opened up, and there's one tablespoon for it. And I hit, and there's a picture of this thing on the wall. And it's for something like that. I said, no, sir, we don't serve that. I said, you asked me to serve me one of those. And she did, and it was grudgingly.
Somehow I can see Dwight doing that, can't you? Go ahead.
When we talk for a lot of different things in business, where it's just expectations weren't met. Some of them are, you know, pretty high level contracts are just missed. And others are just as simple as missed appointments. You set up an appointment with someone, they're going to be in town to meet at this specific time, and the time was on hold. You can't be with your. That's just.
Just keeping your word, yeah. Yeah.
I think what we found in our discussion was that simply dishonest communication, at least it's communication, but is it truly honest? And having to kind of call them. I've been this to my kids. Are they telling me what was real, or do they have to hear my question again? Is this honest communication?
Mm-hmm.
They're hearing my question.
Yeah.
I felt, and then the business world, it's somewhat similar. Although, it could be the case that people are just framing the wrong issue, and they're using up an entire business meeting in order to, you know, share all the evidence they have for something that actually isn't the real issue.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily a hidden agenda. Now, that's real business communication. But this is where they are so focused and over-focused
yeah.
on issues that don't really resolve the real issue.
That any subject that comes up leads to the issue that they're focused on. Yeah.
Jim, I got an illustration. I shouldn't tell, but I got one. I joined Kiwanis a few years ago. About the time I prayed him out of it, we got another president. And I stayed, and I became Secretary of Treasury.
Uh-huh.
Now, the new president was out for a war. They get an award to do certain things.
Uh-huh.
Well, come along out of the new treasury, I go to the board meetings, and I try to keep up with what's going on. Didn't know what was going on. But then he comes to me late in the year and says, you remember that board meeting we had back in September? Remember we discussed the budget? That when you sign off on the fact that we had a budget in September? I said, wait a minute, there's two different things here. You discussed it, but you didn't bring a budget. Well, but you know, you could sign it, couldn't you? And then I guess, okay, but this is against my values, but you did not bring a budget to that meeting. But since it really doesn't make a hell of a difference in this whole situation, I'll sign it anyway, but don't ask me to ever do anything like that.
Huh.
But I felt like I should have told him, forget your oar.
Yeah.
Because he got me a oar. But I got, what do you call that thing, Jim? Something stuff.
Yeah. Well, you can hang it over your toilet, you know. And yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Employers here, once you go stuff in the business, I've helped a couple of young men that were asked to lie about a result of a research study, and they communicated with Chicago, and he wouldn't mind what he didn't say. It came out well. And I know it didn't. He knows that he doesn't want them to know it. He wants them to think that we're ahead of in this development of a process.
Yes.
So I said, boy, let me pray about this. And God really gave me an answer for it.
Huh.
I said, be able to go back to him and say, look, I don't want to do it because I don't believe in lying. Here's why. If I lie for you to them, how do I know you're not lying to me? And how do we know they're not lying to us?
Right.
We bring our trust to the whole situation.
Yeah.
You got a raise. You did. Go ahead. Those are kind of
yeah.
The church doesn't really believe that out of a good training of man's heart, so to speak. So there's no values even in a lot of Christian organizations. And so they speak lies or hyperbole. They make it look better than it should be just because the value is not there, to really be honest. And
yeah.
Of course, we very often in hearing the truth, we don't value the truth either.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this could very well be the Achilles heel of our whole society. This that we're talking about right now. Where there is no integrity, there can really be no future, because we compromise our integrity, in the course of it. Stories flood my mind that I'll deliver you from. But I just want to underscore this, that probably everybody in the room has you've heard the comment that, well, when I see the fish on the back of a car, I look out. In fact, there's a cop in town that's what he says, is when I see a fish in the back of the car, I know that if I have to stop him, I'm going to have trouble. The Christians have a bad reputation. Guys in business, there's some guys that I'm studying with right now, their greatest obstacle was they'd done business with people that are Christians. This is not something new to you guys. This is something you live with. Well, we can't, think about all those bad guys out there. The question is, okay, am I going to be a man of integrity or not? And I tell you, this is more and more counterculture all the time. I mean, this is going to be a big one. Now, let me ask you the question. How about you? Where do you find it most difficult to maintain integrity? Or justice, or whatever. Yeah.
Slander.
Okay.
Something bad about somebody who hurts you, or different from you.
Yeah. Okay.
We were talking about it at our table, and what it appears is, we're probably okay on the big things.
Yeah.
But it's the little things, and it's manipulation with the words that you choose. You want to put a slant on something. And so you choose to put a particular slant on it instead of explaining it exactly the way that it is.
Yes.
You want it to be perhaps viewed in a positive way, so you put a positive slant on it, or a negative way, you put a negative slant on it.
Yes.
And so it's this little bit of integrity that you say, oh, well, this is no big deal. I'm just going to put a little slant on this thing.
Yeah. Yes.
I think it's just a little subtleties with my own wife. Telling her about 80% of the truth. I'm kind of cleaning something up. And
yeah.
So she'll think well of me, and that was enough to get her off my back. Hopefully, that might add about 20%.
Yeah. Good.
And they're not big sin issues, they're just appearances.
Yeah.
It's the little stuff, the little foxes.
Yeah. Yeah, keeping it looking good. Yes.
One of the things I find in the business environment that it occurs, and when it does, it's very evident to me. And being in sales, you want to strike a common relationship with whoever it is that you are interfacing with. And at times, if I find I'm interfacing with someone maybe a little coarse of tongue.
Yeah.
And I'll lapse into that type of a game, if you will.
Yeah.
And they throw a few coarse words, and as soon as they roll out of my mouth, I go, that's not me.
Yeah.
But you feel compromised. So now I have given that person that type of an image that I play in that dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to take it back.
Yeah.
Immediately,
yeah.
If you don't, you say, hey, man, I'm sorry I said that. I got to stop doing that.
Yeah. Good. That's great. Yes.
I guess I've been in business all my life, and if I believe that Satan's a liar and the father of lies, and he's taken heathens captive to do his will, I mean, I'm shocked when heathens do good things in business, not when they do bad things.
Yeah.
And, when you try to feed that, so when you're making the sales calls or whatever it is, it's if you do that in a Christian sort of way, it's very, very different. You don't have to have a fish sticker. You just try to show them the love of Christ. Personal integrity, I think for me, I've always wanted to be liked.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard for me to be confrontational and the justice in when I need to be.
Yeah. Yes.
And so I, dodge this way, dodge this way, I will be offended, and instead of going to that person dealing with it, I want to go to everybody else and get them to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
We hired an operational manager in early March who's the bluntest human being. And he's a godly man, but he just confronts everything. And it was horrifying for the first couple of months. And then I saw the whole morale of the whole place going up because nobody wondered where they stood.
Huh. Great illustration.
I tried to learn godly confrontation from Lowell. And it's been liberating. You know, because people don't have to watch their back anymore.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? The morale goes up. Yeah. Where truth is. Yes.
I have trouble keeping my promise to Norman about, like, when I'm coming home, for example.
Uh-huh.
I'm leaving. I'll be leaving in 5 minutes. No, I just mean I'm not leaving now. I might be leaving in an hour or 5 minutes.
Uh-huh.
I do it all the time. It's the loss of integrity.
Yeah.
It's not good.
Well, you know, I've dealt with all these things you guys have talked about, but when I began to work on this, like I said, you know, several years ago and think about it, I thought, well, you know, I get off pretty easy on this integrity thing because, you know, I, you know, don't lie all that much and that kind of thing. But you know where I caught myself was I struggle with impatience. And, where when I'm impatient and then I respond to my wife or my kids in impatience, I'm unjust all the time. And what I'm doing is I'm dumping my frustration on them in such a way that they feel the blame for what's going on inside of me. Which is, that's unjust, isn't it? And it's those, like you say, the little foxes, those injustices that really devour the relationships. So it's a big deal. This matter of integrity. In fact, in the third world, where you have endemic corruption from top to bottom, from bottom to top, and you wonder why in the world a country like Brazil or wherever isn't cruising economically, everything else. Actually, the root problem is this absence of integrity and the corruption that breeds. We can't survive as a society without integrity. And so the question we have to deal with is, okay, God has called us to this. How do we live it? Yes.
Can you talk about the businesses that don't have integrity that seem to be prospering?
Well, Psalm 37... You had the same thing in mind, didn't you? Well, let's look at Psalm 37. And in verse 5, he gives us some advice. He says, commit your way to the Lord, trust in him, and he will do this. He will make your righteousness shine like the dawn, the justice of your cause like the noonday sun. Well, that's what we're talking about right now. We're saying, okay, commit your way to the Lord, live with integrity and justice. And then in verse 8, he says, refrain from anger and turn from wrath because, of, you know, that works injustice, is what we were just talking about. And then he says, a little while, and the wicked will be no more. Though you look for them, they will not be found. Well, I missed something here. Verse 7. Be still before the Lord, and wait patiently for him. Do not fret when men succeed in their ways, when they carry out their wicked schemes. And what he's saying is just wait, because in verse 9, they will be cut off. But those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land. I mean, some of the guys, like Kenneth Lay and Skilling, and some of these guys are in Enron. I have some mutual friends with those guys, and they, really seem to be, impressive people. And you look at them and you say, wow. They have defined success. They didn't get away with it. Now the problem is some people seem to get away with it. And they die before somebody blows the whistle. And you think, well, yeah, they got away with it. Well, you know, just wait. We'll get there and we'll see what happens there. But I would just say that nobody really gets away with it.
Jim?
Yes?
If you take Psalm 37 and flip it at 73,
okay.
Remember how to get there.
All right.
And in verse 12, people say this book isn't contemporary, relevant today. This is what the wicked are like. Always carefree, they increase in wealth. Doesn't that just burn your bacon? Surely in vain have I kept my heart pure. In vain I've washed my hands in innocence. All day long I've been plagued and punished every morning. If I had said I will speak thus, I would have betrayed your children. When I tried to understand this, it was oppressive to me until, here's the change. I entered the sanctuary of God, and I understood their final destiny.
Yeah.
The door slams hard.
Yeah. And that goes, we don't have to elaborate on that, do we?
You give us compassion for these poor people.
Yeah.
Psalm 73 says, these fat calves never have been drunk. Their cattle never abort.
Yeah.
Yep.
Horse doctor's analogy, if I ever heard.
Okay, let's go on to the next characteristic that we see in God that serves as a prototype for the way we relate to our society. What we're doing is we're saying we learn from God how to live redemptive relationship. And the second one is love. And the passage that we started off with was the one in Ephesians 5, where he says, be imitators of God, therefore, as dearly loved children, and live a life of love. And of course, the measurement then is just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. Can we have a relationship of any kind without love? Well, you say, yeah, I can, you know, relate to my employees and stuff like that without love. Let's leave that question hanging. Is it possible to have any kind of relationship where there isn't love? The question, of course, is what is love? Now, sometimes that's kind of a no-brainer. It's easy to love when our friends are attentive and caring, our children obedient, they'll do what you tell them to. They're reasonable, and you can talk to them, and it all comes out. But then there are other times when loving is really hard stuff. Matthew 5, Jesus says, "You've heard that it was said." This is verse 43. "You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be like the sons of your Father in heaven. He causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good, sends the rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Even tax collectors do that." But then he says, "Be perfect, therefore, as your Heavenly Father is perfect." Well, you know, what is this business of loving your enemy? A couple years ago, I was in Nigeria with people that are working with Muslims. And there's a team of navigators. We were off in a little town. There was about 30 of us, and we were talking. And my roommate was Musa Yashin. He's a guy that's on nav staff in Nigeria. And 3 weeks before this gathering, the Muslims had come to his brother-in-law's house, brother-in-law and sister, and torched the house, and he came running out with his little son, and they were waiting for him with machetes, and they hacked him to death, the father and the son. Well, I'd come into the room there where we were meeting, and there would be Musa flat on the floor, his face on the floor. And he was just processing his grief. And I'd see him, And he was just, you know, in pain. Well, one day we got into this chapter and in this section, and we were talking about what it is to love your enemies. And it says, if you only greet your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Even pagans do that. And he says, be perfect, as your Father is perfect. So really what it boils down to is those enemies that you have, say hello to them. And when we say hello to somebody that's an enemy, we're really obeying Jesus. I mean, that's, pretty significant. So, the next day after we talked about this, we started out the next morning, and Musa says, well, look, he says, I have something to say. He says, when I look at this passage of scripture, this paragraph, he says, I find it really challenging. Because what do you do when you get up in the morning and the first person you meet as you walk down the road is the guy that killed your brother and your nephew the day before? Do you greet him, or what do you do? Well, he said, yeah, I understand that I'm supposed to greet him. You know, it's things like that that make me realize how radical our gospel is. Integrity is radical. Love is even more radical. Because love is a verb. It's not just an emotion. It's not a feeling. It's a verb. It calls for action. And as you look through the scriptures and you see where it talks about love, it's always on how it acts out. And so love is acting in ways that heal and build the other up. So I look at the other person, I think, okay, what do I need to do to help this person heal? What do I do to build this person up? It's doing what is best for the other. Now, you know, our children don't always get what they want because we love them. But if the people around me, I look at them and I think, okay, now what is going to build them up? What is going to make things better for them? Then I am loving. So love is really a decision or a choice. I don't know about you guys, but every day when I get up, I have to decide whether I'm going to love my wife that day or not. And I find that if I just let it slide, then the sharp edge of that attention is blunted. I become indifferent. But it is a choice, and it's an everyday choice. And guys that say, well, I don't love my wife anymore, well, they've been making the wrong choices. And we go back to that, and we think, okay, if love is a choice, then I can choose to love or I can choose to not love. And it's not that someone else has done something that keeps me from that. I'm in control of that. So here we have, you know, the truth and the love. And the question is, can there be any relationship with another person if we don't love? I think we can have an impact on other people. But if there's going to be any kind of reconciliation, if we are going to be agents of reconciliation, then we are going to be seeking what's good for the other person. Any comments on that? I'm going to put us into discussion on this in just a sec then. Okay, here's what I want you to process in your group. What do you make of this command to love one's enemy? What might that mean for you? Now, you may say, I don't have any enemies, but you probably have some competitors. People who you would rather see not succeed because one way or another they rub against you the wrong way. What does that mean to you? Okay, talk about that.
Adversary or enemy actually becomes a friend, even though you're working, you know, in a competitive marketplace.
Will that fly in a marketplace?
Could I just ask you to comment on one thing?
Yes. A little louder.
There seems to be a correlation between your enemies, divine appointments, and those that you're called to minister to.
Your enemies, a correlation between your enemies, divine appointments,
and those that
and the people that you're called to minister to. Elaborate on that. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, we were talking earlier about Ephesians and the sovereignty of God, and there typically, you know, if you take enough steps back, there is no randomness.
Right. Okay.
And many times the individual that God has brought into your path, which really chases,
yes,
confronts, exposes certain areas in your life, not only expose the character weaknesses, but you're called to minister to. I know personally that, you know, when I worked on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange,
yes,
I was hated because of my belief.
Uh-huh.
Because of the Catholic sentiment down there, I was seen as a traitor.
Uh-huh.
And when I, for years, I would pass by people and they would curse at me. I mean,
yeah.
And I try to get people fired.
Uh-huh.
You know, in order just, you know, because they caused me pain.
Okay.
But the people that caused me the pain ended up coming to the Lord.
Yeah.
So it was an issue of surrendering to. So, I mean, you're all of it. I'm asking you the question.
Okay.
Talk about.
All right. Well, we're getting now down to the crux of, really, we're getting down to the crux of the gospel. God is holy and just, but he also loves. There's tension between those two. That's what you're talking about. Why is it that you just get angry and you shut down toward those people? What is it in you that makes you want to do that? Well, you feel like they're getting away with something. And somehow or other, you have got to demonstrate, you have got to it's kind of on your plate to bring justice. And you're afraid it's not going to happen, so you get mad at them. And that's where an awful lot of tension comes, is the tension between our call to love and our call to be just. You see the connection? And so often what happens is we're deadlocked between those two drives. Well, you know, this is not fair. I'm against this guy because what he has done has been dishonest and so on. And so therefore I can't be his friend. I can't relate to him. But the gospel calls us to take the little initiative and to show this person that we love him. Awful. A terrible thing to be called to do. But that's what the gospel calls on us to do. Now, I think often what happens is because we do not understand the dynamic between being just and loving, we're caught in the impasse. We don't know what to do with it. But remember in Ephesians 4:15, it says, we speak the truth in love. Loving your enemy doesn't mean that you walk away from truth and just let him get by with whatever. So the question with your enemy is, okay, how do I speak the truth in love? You may not be the person to speak the truth, but until we take the next step, we're at an impasse. And this is where most of our relationships just sit in the doldrums for 20, 30, 40 years, as where somebody violates our sense of justice and we can't love them anymore. And so there we are. It's a deadlock. Yes?
It seems to me, we touched on this earlier, we can only love if we believe that God is a God of justice. We were looking at Psalm 73, I think it was.
Yes.
Understanding what the final end of them will be. If we don't believe that God is really just and we want justice, then we have to create it for ourselves.
Yeah.
If we believe that God is really just and that in the end everything is going to come out as it should, then then it's no longer our responsibility to make sure they get what they deserve.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Yes.
Booker T. Washington said once that he would never let a man put him back into slavery by making him hate him.
Huh.
And I love that because you either going to love somebody or hate somebody. It's not a neutral position.
Yes.
And so, you know, time can go by and that becomes a low-grade hatred.
Yes.
It's like running a low-grade fever. And it's just there chewing around. And I think what I've tried to learn to do is, like, I really can't forgive this guy. He has hurt me too bad.
Yes.
But I can submit to Christ and let Christ forgive him through me because it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just let him work on my motives and take that hatred away.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a break here. Lauren is here, and want to listen to him. But let's leave it at this. Where we are, most of our lives are littered with abandoned relationships that are just too painful to continue with. And it's because this person has violated our notion of what's right and just, and we find that we just don't have the energy to practice the verb to love. And so there we sit. We're at an impasse. Now, how do we unlock it? Now, in the gospel, we have the golden key to unlock that. And that's what we'll get to when I come back. So I'll turn it over to whoever is going to introduce Lauren. And let's see, where's Jim? Yeah.
What I'm saying was young navigator staff man with Dawson Cox, the founder, died in and on the 6th. So for the next 30 years,
yes, sir.
82 years old, and he's battled cancer a couple of times, and it's all in remission right now. He's got all his hair, well, a good hair anyway.
All that I'll have.
He's the sharpest attack, and he just wanted to come say hello to us. So.
Thank you, and stay standing for a little bit. I don't know why they hooked me up here, but because what I have to say, well, you can always reuse the tape. But stretch a little bit. If you need to go to the bathroom, do it. It's hard to talk to a guy that's, you know, can't wait. You guys are getting older, some of you, and you might need to take care. So feel free. Now, that'll embarrass you, so you don't want to go out there. I know. Okay, stretch a little bit and then have a seat. Jim asked me if I would come over and just, didn't know what word to use, but I think greet you. And I'm happy to do that. And at 82, you need to have a little prompter list to see what I was going to say. That's not because it's going to be so long, but so that I don't wander off. Let's see, 1 dozen medium eggs, or 1 half gallon and 1%. Oh, no, that's my grocery list for later. I do that after I leave here. And this one, all this has to do with the vitamins I'm to get. Take 18 pills a day. You know, I used to think these old folks take a lot of pills. Well, they do. That's not it. In fact, I don't think I even need it. But I wanted to thank you, Jim, for this privilege. And the first thing I want to do is, I don't think Roger is here. Anderson? Not Roger Anderson, Roger Fleming? No. Well, I'm so grateful for Roger, and I'm sure many of you are too who know Roger, for taking over this, the leadership of this work when I left it. And if there ever was a godly man or godly couple that walked this earth, it's Roger and his wife. And we're grateful for them. And then for Jim here, who then took it over next. And we had a little time together on Wednesday. He told me that he thinks about the BNP ministry when he goes to bed, when he gets up in the morning. And I said, well, you've got it. Yeah. And you know, too, that that's when you've got the hang of it. So it's a real privilege. Thank you. I thought I might just share a couple little things. Now, who hath despised the day of small things? One of the great blessings to me to working with businessmen, it has purified my methodology. You've got to make it simple, obviously. And it's helped me then to think through again and again, what are the absolute minimums to living the kind of a life we want to live? And that's been exceedingly helpful as life has been winding down for me and energy diminishes. And you just have to be careful how you expend it. One of the things, in fact, some people ask me, are you writing, what are you doing these days? You traveling? Well, no. If I were, I wouldn't be here right now because my sister's husband died last week and the funeral's tomorrow out in California. So I do the next best thing. We talk each night on the phone and pray together. Are you writing any books? Well, I've concluded, Jim, I don't know enough about anything to write a book on anything. And especially now, when things keep narrowing down. One of the things that's come to my mind is getting back to 1 Corinthians 2:2. For I determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And various things have come into my life that have helped me and focused me. But an odd thing happened. The climax of that for me was about 2 weeks ago when I walked through the living room and Lucy was surfing the TV and there was Donahue. Well, on the screen it had the subject of their discussion, which was, is Jesus the only way to heaven? Well, I thought, if there's any program I won't learn anything from, it's Donahue. So I didn't. I didn't stay. But that question stuck with me. And I thought, you know, that's the wrong question. In fact, it's almost irrelevant. If Jesus is only Jesus, of course. He's not only not the only way to heaven, He's not a way to heaven because He was an imposter. But if Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, then whether Donahue or anybody else likes it or not, He is what He said, the only way to the Father. It kind of helps focus things again. Then there's another question, and I don't know, I may be dead wrong on this one. Maybe on the other one, I don't, but not on this, on this one. What would Jesus do? Well, that's very helpful to a lot of people. But I thought, what would Jesus do if you're an 82-year-old man? And nothing would come to me. Oh, I love people. Yeah? But you know, that's not the right question. What would Jesus have me to do? Takes it and puts it in a different realm. And that's easy, because through the man he deputized to speak for him, Paul, he said, teach the older men to be sound in faith. And love, well, starts out, be temperate, worthy of respect, self-controlled, sound in faith, in love, in endurance, perseverance, hanging in there. I've been rather discouraged a little bit over the winter. Just little times. Lucy and I have been married 60 years in June. And we have worked for all those years trying to reach relatives. Kept in touch. Prayed for them. 70 to 100. Visit. Take things to them. With very little of any. Just one visible result. And now I know mentally how to handle that. But emotionally, I don't all the time.
And then I console myself with Jesus said in Mark 6. You know, prophet's not without honor except in his own country, among his own relatives, and in his own house. But then 2 weeks ago, one of our daughters, we have four daughters, two sons. This one took me out to breakfast for my birthday. And during that time, she said, Dad, I got to tell you something. Where I work, she worked for Cook Publishing. We had a department meeting, and there was a discussion, and it came up, who is your model? And they came around to me, and I said, well, I don't have a model, but I have a hero, my dad. They said, well, why was that? She said, because he perseveres. He hangs in there, even when he's sick. And I thought, even the family, when I don't think they're listening, they're watching. And at this stage of life, the greatest thing I can do is be a book that's being read. And in my little circle, that's far more important than the little sermonettes that I might give. What a privilege. What a privilege. Now, there's one thing I wanted more. I wanted to say, but I can't remember what it might have been. No, that's not necessary. Let's see this one. No. But what would Jesus have me do? I don't know. If he's 82 years old and married to an 80-year-old woman with a lot of arthritis. To try to imagine that, it didn't help me. It may help you, but sorry, guys. I'm just talking about me. But when I ask the question, what Jesus want me to do, I know very clearly. It's no problem. It's not complicated. Husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. I can remember that. Can you? And that's not always easy, too, but you got to watch, remember it. And the other one is 1 Peter 3:7. There's two things. Be considerate and treat him with respect. So every day you pray about that. So obedience to his word, to me at least, sure simplifies life. And what you just finished on, I'll have to tell you another little story. My next door neighbor, we live in a condo, whose door, I checked the other day, is not more than 4 feet from mine. Now, I'd have to say he's an old codger. He's a couple years older than I. We've lived there 5 years now, and I've been trying to win that guy's heart. We've gone out to lunch. I brought him over here. He took me to Air Force Base where he was the commanding officer before he left. But you know, he's probably the angriest man I ever met in my life. Well, something happened. I don't know what happened. In June, he quit talking to me 6 months ago. He won't speak to me. Just the other day, you know, we used the same sidewalk out to get the mail. He's coming back with his. I'm going out to get mine. I said, hi, Bob. Not a word. Lucy gave him a book for Christmas, two of them. 2 days later, that book is stuffed back in our door. Now, you know what I wanted to do? Bob, a little thing I could do in my printer. You can go to hell, Lauren. But what did Jesus say? We're just talking about love your enemies. Do good to them that hate you. Pray for them that despitefully use you and persecute. And that's all I need to know how to treat Bob. And I desperately want to please the Lord in how I treat him, whether he responds or not. Well, thanks. I'll stop right there, okay? I was going to bring an egg timer and set it so it would go off. I don't know how long I've been up here, but it's too long. Okay. Anybody have a simple question they want to ask me? Yeah. I'm most embarrassed. But in working with men, businessmen, I start with, I took Dawson's rather rigorous trio for himself. An hour a day, a verse a day, and a life a day. Spend an hour a day with the Lord, memorize a verse a day, and touch a life a day. Well, I've scaled that down a bit, just a wee bit. An hour a day with the Lord, a disciplined hour, a verse for the day, not a new one every day, but a verse for the day, and then touch a life a day. And in working with people like Carrie Humphreys or others by phone, that was the basic minimums that we would do. And you know how it is. We'd start with the 7 minutes with God, then we'd start with a little different way of approaching scripture memory. Then after some weeks or however long it was, we're ready to start focusing on touching a life a week. And when that began, you know what happened. It's happened to you many times. Up till then, we did this by phone. We could do it in 30 to 40 minutes. But when we started reaching out to touch lives, it would take us an hour and a half to cover the ground. But those simple little three things to build on. That's why I couldn't write a book on it, because it's too simple. And I do that today. Today's do list. No, I didn't bring it. But I have up to the left would be my verse for the day, and so on. And then try to touch a life a day, whether for him that meant a non-Christian, unbeliever. For me, that means anybody. But that would mean if I'm in wherever I am, the doctor's office, the nurse, taking chemo, calling my sister, whoever, that at least somebody on purpose, you seek to touch a life for that day. And those three things will lead you into a lot of others. But to me, they're probably most basic things I could get somebody else to do. Thank you. Oh, no. Another question? I know I get running off too long. That's why I don't want to stay up here.
Can you look back over now? You had one piece of advice for us. Living in the world we live in, the struggles that we have. You give us one piece of advice to remember.
Living in the world we live in. Well, the other day I was walking through our office, and one of the ladies there has a desk where people come by and speak to her for information. I always speak when I go by. I said, "Has anybody asked you how is the world treating you?" And why did you say yes? I said, "Would you ask me that question? Because I want to answer somebody." She said, "Okay, how is the world treating you?" I said, "I'm in terrible odds with the world. It's trying to squeeze me into its mold, and I don't want to be like it." And you know, then you go just a little deeper. I don't think this is the answer you're looking for. But my closest friend, and godly a man, and a disciple of men, was my brother Leonard. He died year before last. And over 6 weeks, 2 months, as he was dying, and he knew it, I talked with him each evening, call him. He lived in California, too. Finally, it got to where he couldn't speak above a whisper. So our other brother got a phone that would amplify his whisper so we could talk. And as we would pray each night, and I would do the praying, and I was amazed, and this is what I want just to impress here. Here he is, he's dying, and he knows it. I'm an 80-year-old man. And the predominant prayer request we had for each other was Psalm 19:14. Let the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. So it starts down in here, doesn't it? With the natural tendencies, the world around us, and as we were talking before, increasingly hostile. But to be salt and light. I don't think that means to go around sprinkling salt. I think it means to be salt. And if I understand that right, salt, the big thing about it, it has to be pure. Or it loses its bite, its savor. And then the other thing, and I've had to work on this, to be light, you got to be visible, Jesus said. And my tendency would be to not want to get up out of a lazy boy, especially when I had cancer. I mean, when I was on treatments. But to let your light shine. And I think to me, myself, as I reflected on being with you guys, and what is it we're trying to build? Well, other foundation can no man lay than that which is Jesus Christ. And if any man build on this foundation, gold, silver, precious stones. You can't build on immorality, laissez-faire. I think that's why the laborers are still few. The Psalm 1 kind of people are 1 in 1,000. Charlie Riggs says they're 1 in 10,000. But these, I guess what I'm saying here, Dwight, is what are the absolute core values, if you want to call them basics? And as Skip Gray would say, don't waste your ammunition on secondary targets. Hey, thanks for letting me come over. You know what it does for me? It kind of helps me refresh a little bit. And I kind of like sharing with people, too. You know? Thanks.
Let's pray for Lauren, and let's just kneel. I'll start the prayer and then ask Harvey Osmond to close. Almighty Father, Lord God Almighty, thank you for your predestination, your greatness, your power, your love, your precision, your planning, your execution, and especially in the way in which you've modeled it to us through Lauren Sanney. And not only to us, but to hundreds, thousands, thousands of thousands. Thank you for these times when you've given him a whole body temporarily. Make his days comfortable and full of fresh insights into your word. Wonder at his relationship with you and a desire to be steadily at it each day with a plan of how he might help establish and fulfill your kingdom and do the things that Jesus would have him to do with joy and faithfulness. Thank you for the model that he has given us. We pray in Jesus' name.
Take a break. Can you just do a picture or something for some of you guys to go for a break? Snap a picture of somebody else.
10 minutes.
Jeremiah is giving his jeremiads against the people of Israel. And in verse 4, he says, I will make them abhorrent to all the kingdoms of the earth. Why? Because of what Manasseh, son of Hezekiah, king of Judah, did in Jerusalem. So here Jeremiah puts all the weight, all the responsibility for the decline and crash of Judah on Manasseh. So I thought, well, that's quite a story. Let's, you know, see what Manasseh did that was so bad. Well, you get to 2 Chronicles chapter 33. Let's look at that. 2 Chronicles chapter 33. And it tells the story of Manasseh. It says, Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king. He reigned in Jerusalem for 55 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, followed the detestable practices of the nations the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. He rebuilt the high places that his father Hezekiah had demolished. He erected altars to the Baals, made Asherah poles. He bowed down to all the starry hosts and worshipped them. I mean, here's this king leading Judah, and it was just absolute perversion. It says he built altars in the temple of the Lord. Can you imagine that? You're in this holy place, and he builds an altar to one of the gods, of which the Lord had said, "My name will remain in Jerusalem forever." In both the courts of the temple of the Lord, he built altars to all the starry hosts. He sacrificed his sons in the fire. So he burned his sons in offerings to the gods, practiced sorcery, divination, and witchcraft, consulted mediums and spiritists. And then it says, understatement, he did much evil in the eyes of the Lord, provoking him to anger. And then it goes on to describes more of what Manasseh did. And then in verse 9, it says, but Manasseh led Judah and the people of Jerusalem astray so that they did more evil than the nations the Lord had destroyed before the Israelites. Well, if you were God right then and you were looking at Manasseh, what would you do? Man, he would just be carbon. I mean, it'd be over. What does the Lord do? The Lord spoke to Manasseh and his people, but they paid no attention. So he steps it up a little bit. And it says, so the Lord brought against them the army commanders of the king of Assyria, who took Manasseh prisoner, put a hook in his nose, bound him with bronze shackles, and took him to Babylon. So here's Manasseh. He's got a hook in his nose. He's got shackles. He's walking. He's dragging chains. And he's going down the road to Babylon. Well, now, that's not the most comfortable way to travel. You know, it's United is still better than that. You know, just, and so then it says in the next verse, in his distress, he sought the favor of the Lord his God, and humbled himself greatly before God. And when he prayed to him, the Lord was moved by his entreaty, listened to his plea, and what does the Lord do? So he brought him back to Jerusalem, to his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Lord is God. The power of humility. Where a relationship with God, a man's position is restored after he had done that kind of evil. Well, in our relationships, what I find is that where I've really messed up, humility, if I will really stop, listen, and hear what this other person has to say, then understanding comes. And then I can begin to act on it. It breaks the logjam. This impasse that we're talking about here between these two gets broken by humility. Let me press on, and then we'll process at our tables several of these in a row. The next one is serving. And again, we take that out of Philippians chapter 2. Probably the most vivid illustration of this that we've got in the scriptures that I know of is John 13, where Jesus washes his disciples' feet. It was the Passover. It says Jesus knew the time had come for him to leave this world. And So the context doesn't give us the whole story here. What really was going on was they were arguing over who was the greatest. And so Jesus doesn't say anything, but he gets up, takes his clothes off, puts a towel around him, gets some water, and starts washing one of the guy's feet. And so here you are, and you've figured out by now that this is the Son of God. And you see him coming towards you, and he's washing everybody's feet. And you're horrified. You're thinking, he's going to wash my feet. You know, what in the world am I going to do? So, you know, finally he comes to you, and Peter says, are you going to wash my feet? And he says, you'll never wash my feet. And then Jesus says, well, unless I wash you, you'll never have any part with me. And then Peter says, well, you know, just, you know, give me the bath, the whole thing. And what does Jesus say to him? You're already clean. What do you mean you're already clean? Well, what he's really saying is that they have been reconciled to God. But then he says, a person who has a bath needs only wash his feet. His whole body is clean. You are clean, though not every one of you, referring to Judas. Then when he finished washing their feet, and they're sitting there, you know, imagine this turmoil going on in their minds. He says, do you understand what I have done for you? He asked. You call me teacher and Lord, and rightly so. That's what I am. Now that I, your teacher and Lord, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I've set an example that you should do as I've done for you. So there are certain sects within the church where the people literally get out a basin of water and a towel, and they do that. You know, when they meet, they take it literally. I don't think that's what he's talking about. What is he talking about? Yeah. In what sense, servant? What's that?
That's a humble servant.
Yeah. And who do we serve?
One another.
And what is washing another guy's feet? Road dirt. We pick up road dirt all the time. You help each other keep the road dirt off. And so we talk about accountability. And we take accountability to being something where I exercise authority over you. Well, really, if we're going to have a right understanding about accountability, it's I'm going to help you keep the road dirt off. I don't judge you. I just help you get the dirt off. What does that mean? Well, if another person understands that what I'm really interested in is their good, that I am being alert to serve them in such a way that their lives are enhanced, what does that do to my relationship? Oh, man. I mean, that's where the trust is built, isn't it? So there are a lot of ways in which we serve. Now, Paul gives a one-liner in 1 Corinthians 4:1, he says, now we know that it's required of a servant to be faithful. I find in my family, in my household, just, you know, in everyday life around my wife and kids, I need to be faithful. There are certain things that I need to be doing if the family is going to feel secure. Just certain duties that I carry out. I manage the finances. I do a lot of the cooking. Every couple is going to find the way they connect with each other and carry their part. Now, where the relationship breaks down is where once that is established, one partner begins to falter on those things that they're expected to do, that you just understood within that relationship. When that begins to falter, then the offenses come and things break down. So a servant is faithful. He does what he is supposed to do in such a way that the other people, you know, they're keeping the road dirt off. Life is good. That takes us to, and I would say serving is, it's just being attentive to another's needs and meeting them. That's what a servant does. He's attentive to another person's needs and meet them. There are a zillion ways to serve, but basically the idea is, okay, let's fulfill our role in our relationship. Now when it comes into business and so on, it has all kinds of application, but I just want to establish that idea. Let's go on to forgiveness. You know, I think that forgiveness, as I've kind of gotten around in various cultures and so on, I think forgiveness is, the more I see, the more I'm convinced that forgiveness is unique to this message. That you don't see it anyplace else. You look in, there are what they call shame cultures, like the Arab culture, and a lot of the Asian cultures are shame cultures. It's where I have to defend my honor. I have to protect kind of the integrity of my own notion of right and wrong. And so what you're going to get in an Arab culture is, you know, you've offended my father, and he wasn't able to even the score, and so I'm going to have to do that. And so the idea of revenge propels an awful lot of life. To even the score, or in other cultures, it's to save face. There's an absence, there's a way of dealing with offenses that is absent, or forgiveness is absent. Or take the African cultures. So often you get the impression that, you know, they're jovial, happy people, friendly, and that's on the surface. But what really controls a lot of the animist societies, let's say, is fear. Because they know, you know, that you and I may be, look like friends, we may be smiling and patting each other on the back, but how do I know that you don't have something against me and you'll put a hex on me? And in the villages, in Africa, this happens a lot. People, they come home from a day of work and they drop dead. And so, you know, it's a hex and it's working and there's power in that. And so, I'm not going to let you know that I hate you. I'm going to smile and be friendly, but I'm looking for the opportunity. I'm maneuvering to get the upper hand on you and put a hex on you. And so, there is a whole, you know, idea of self-defense. Well, in America and in our secular society, what has replaced the idea of forgiveness? Tolerance. All right. Justice.
Compromise.
Okay. Acceptance. All right. So we kind of rearrange things in such a way that we can live with it. Or in our schools of psychology. You know, really it was my mother that made me be the way I am. And so I shift blame. I shift responsibility. And so I can't accommodate the real thing, which is that there has been an offense and I'm responsible. And so we shift it around. This verse in Ephesians 4, be kind one to another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, even as God in Christ forgave you, is the pattern that we're called to follow. What is forgiveness? I've got a friend. You know, forgiveness is not just acting like it never happened. Because it has happened. I have a friend who has been offended 3 times in a major way. He's a man with means. He had a friend who was going bankrupt. And so he stepped in along with a couple other guys and shorted him up to the tune of about $1 million. And then there was another guy who his businesses were going bad, and he helped him put them together. And then he was heavily supporting a Christian worker who, in the end, just kind of took advantage of him. And the person that was going bankrupt got back on his feet and then went bankrupt again. never gave my friend any kind of recognition that he'd been helped. The person who had had these businesses that were failing, the very same thing. Instead of being closer to him, they were estranged. They were enemies. And the Christian worker that he had been supporting won't even talk to him. So here's this guy, and I'm watching him just getting eaten up by his bitterness. And he just, you could just see that it had possessed him. So I sat down with him and I said, "Hey, you know, you need to forgive these guys." I said, "You're taking them to bed with you. They're eating you alive." And he says, "So I should forgive just so that I can sleep better at night." He says, "Where's justice in that?" Pretty good question. Do I forgive just so that I can feel better? Do I just ignore each and every offense that comes along? Well, not really. So where do we go on this? Well, open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 18. Verse 21, Peter came to Jesus, says, "Lord, how many times should I forgive my brother?" And Jesus says, let me tell you a story. Here was this guy, this is verse 23, that owed 10,000 talents of silver to his king, which is about $20 million in today's currency. And he called him in and he says, you're not able to pay. I'm going to sell you your wife and your kids and recover as many of my losses as I can. And then that's how I'm going to settle this. In verse 26, the servant fell on his knees, said, "Be patient with me, and I will pay back everything." So the master took pity on him, let him go. He walks out the door, and here's this guy that he's been chasing that says, "I'll pay you next week, next week, next week," and it never comes. And he grabs him by the throat. He says, "Well, now, what's just here? You know, you've told me before you pay, you're just lying to me, so I'll have you put in debtor's prison." And so that's what happens. The king hears about this. And the master called the servant in, verse 32. He says, "I canceled all the debts of yours because you begged me to. Shouldn't you have done the very same thing as I did?" In his anger, his master turned him over to the jailer to be tortured until he should pay back all he owned. So here's the story. What is forgiveness? On what basis? What was this servant supposed to do in this case? Let him go? Why?